Welcome to One Seat Over, a Yale Herald podcast centered around telling the untold stories of the classmates you don't know. Because the person you keep getting placed in a Zoom breakout room with, your Durfee's nemesis, and the one person you once made meaningful eye contact with in the Zeta basement all have incredible lives and stories to tell. And it's about time we listen. So grab a seat and join us. I'm your host, Mahika Patel, a junior in Davenport majoring in sociology, and today on our second episode, four Yalies are going to be answering the question, why did you do that? Highlighting some of their trials and tribulations as they try to navigate their ever-changing lives. Today we have four storytellers from all different walks of life calling in from different corners of the world. We have Luna Garcia, Silliman College, 22, calling in from LA, Ronak Gandhi, Morse College, 22, calling in from Fort Worth, Texas, Addy Kim, J.E., 21, calling in from New Haven, and Ingrid Ellis, Ben Franklin, 23, calling in from Colorado. Without further ado, let's get to our storytellers. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Thanks for being here. Before we start, do any of you previously know each other?
I don't think so.
Oh, I don't think so.
Sick. Well, this is everybody, so... We're about to jump right into your stories, but first, let's talk a little bit about mistakes in general. About why do you do that? Being a Yalie, going to a school that, for better or for worse, often tries to reflect excellence and perfection, do you find yourself getting more hung up on your mistakes? Do you feel like other people are hoping or waiting for you to screw up?
I think a competitive, like academically, it can get kind of competitive, but just on an interpersonal basis, I don't think I'm like looking for people to fail.
Yeah, I would say the person that's out there looking for me to fail is probably myself. I find that I'm more critical of my own actions and my own mistakes a lot more than perhaps I'm willing to admit. And I think a lot more than perhaps I should be all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say I definitely think that it's the case at Yale where with most things that it's all self-imposed. And I find that I differ a little bit from most people because I never had that tendency to expect things of myself when I was younger to the point where I did fail a lot and a lot of people thought that I was like a mess. So I think like now that I've come into my, you know, mature age at 22, I think that I have a complex now where I'm like that little kid, like dirty little kid who just like was always screwing up is like just still within me, and I'm trying to like suppress them all the time. Yeah.
I've got to say, similarly at my not so mature age of 21, I find that, you know, I have that like the suppressing the little kid a lot, but I also find that, you know, I feel like there's a lot more gravity to like all these decisions now that like, you know, we're in college and like we're about to enter this new stage of our lives where like we can't be kids anymore. So, you know, like every decision I do is like could impact the rest of my life. And so I guess that's part of the reason why I think like decision making is so important, and I get really hung up on it and like beat myself up about it.
I delay making decisions as long as I can. I consider all the options. It's the Libra in me. I take forever to make up my mind about things because it just feels, I guess it's, I don't want to regret any decision that I make or look back and say, I shouldn't have done that. I should have done the other option instead. So it takes me a while to, I guess, make up my mind.
What's interesting about this question about like, do you feel like everybody's watching you fail, especially right now, is that like during the pandemic, it's like people are largely not visible to each other. And it's like, I find social media, I mean, like, of course we're not in space together. And so that's one thing, but a large space in which that plays out is on social media, which I find to be absolutely so fucking boring. Sorry. Social media, which I find to be so boring right now. I mean, I think it's a resource, but I don't think it's a way to gauge what anybody is doing right now. And so for that reason, I think it's like this question of like, do you find yourself more critical of yourself, or like, do you expect people to be watching you more, is really like, I think it's taken on new terms during the pandemic. And I think, at least for me, it's like, I feel like I'm doing things with more authenticity, not expecting to be visible. And my failures too, like I feel probably a little more open to failing, which is maybe a bad thing.
And let's get to our stories. First up, we have Luna Garcia sharing a story of a breakup nightmare.
I think we should break up. Just as Tom said this, that's not his real name, but you know, I'm nice. Close to a dozen tourists began to take pictures of us. My soon-to-be ex-boyfriend and I were sitting in the Silla Glue, the type of thing you'd find in a magazine called Garden Smart or Casa Couture or I Care About My House More Than My Husband, which had caught the tour group's attention. In the beginning, our relationship felt like winning a stuffed animal at one of those rigged carnival games. He cuffed his jeans, spoke four languages, and he was French. The type of guy that, even though I wasn't from the Midwest, made me feel like I was. I scored the grand prize, my first cool boyfriend. We were both adventurous in the way that 20-year-olds are and had our fair share of menage a trois exclusively between me, him, and his ego. Looking back, I should have known he wasn't being honest about our relationship. He always told me that I smelled nice, but a previous ex had told me that I always smell faintly of whatever food I had just eaten. In college, I was cooler, smoked a cigarette one time, prettier, now knew what contouring meant, and smarter, could now spell broccoli without spell check, than I ever thought possible as a high schooler. There was a je ne sais quoi I knew I had but could not pronounce. I was like the diverse background actress in a show about white college students in New England. In my head, social capital and a bachelor's degree were signs of evolution. Adding a boyfriend to the equation seemed to me a logical extension. What was a relationship if not a reflection of all the best parts of yourself? It was only when hormones and a fear of commitment shattered this visage that I discovered the answer. The worst parts of yourself. I think that the first moments of a breakup are exactly like the final moments before you die. You relive your greatest hits. My mind jumped to finals week. Sleep deprived and stir crazy, we spent $40 on last minute concert tickets. Tom spouted out facts about the Haitian Revolution as we moshed with music fans twice our age. Then, after kissing me in the back of the theater, told me how he thought it racist that the French history class omitted the insurrection completely. If I had been paying attention, I would have learned that Haiti was declared a free republic in 1804. Instead, I learned that kissing a Frenchman was the same as kissing an American, except with a lot more tongue and a little bit of self-aggrandizement. I was frozen in the igloo. Tom didn't take his eyes off me. He acted as if he had done this 100 times before, like his fifth language was heartbreak. I didn't have time to prepare a moving rebuttal or a tear-jerking monologue. All I could blurt out was, oh, come on, are you serious? Why did I do that? That's the best I could say. I sounded like a washed-up comedian in a network sitcom. I mean, the analogy wasn't too far from the truth. The two of us were moderately attractive, tastefully diverse, and had a live studio audience of about 20 prospective college students tuning in. The only thing missing was a laugh track. He blinked a few times before exclaiming, why is that your reaction? Well, at least I surprised him. I am a veteran of heartbreak. In middle school, before I was pretty and still had cystic acne, I would comfort sobbing preteens in the girls' bathroom. They would talk about cheating, fingering, and all the other experiences that I had only read about in fan fiction. Sometimes the girls would offer me advice. Be direct. Wear leggings. Oh, don't worry, I'm sure you'll meet someone once your skin clears up. These conversations prepared me for love about as well as first-person shooter games prepared 14-year-olds for war. We might go through the logistics of why and how could you, and but I bought you a neti pot for Valentine's Day. Avoiding eye contact, Tom explained that every time he said, I love you, he felt like he was lying. My solar plexus burned, which either meant that I was about to cry or had just eaten Korean barbecue. Sniffing my hand, I smelled like dining hall quiche, so I narrowed it down to the former. No one tells you that heartbreak feels suspiciously like acid reflux. "Do you need tissues?" he asked. I blew my nose into his t-shirt. "I don't have tissues. What do you think you are, the Ritz-Carlton?" I snapped, verbatim. In an effort to cheer me up, he then added, "At least you'll have plenty of comedy material after dating me." To which I responded, "I'm not going to be able to joke about you for a very long time." I remembered when Tom, charmingly confused, admitted that I was the first funny girl that he had ever dated. At that time, I took that statement to be both a green light and a red flag. Okay, so he didn't know that women could be funny. That's all right, maybe it was a cultural thing. In Europe, women weren't legally allowed to tell jokes. In his eyes, I was probably brave for being what he called an absurdist. Either way, it was that memory that did it for me. I started to sob in the igloo. Several days after the breakup, depressed and incapable of eating, I would go to the Silliman Good Life Center. A wellness coach, if you wanted a real therapist, you had to cry on the phone with Yale Mental Health and confirm that, yes, you did have private insurance, would tell me in between sips of matcha ashwagandha tea that the reason I couldn't eat was because I was consumed by my own grief. What I needed to do, she explained, was zoom out and see the bigger picture. If I was an outsider looking in, I would see that my pain is temporary. I would also probably see that this wellness coach was not a licensed medical professional. This therapist, Yogi, said that I needed to learn that heartbreak wasn't the end of the world. And you know what? 3 weeks later, with the introduction of murder hornets, travel bans, and a global pandemic, the world seemed to agree. I imagined him at 40 years old. Not having spoken with me since college, something would jar his memory about his sophomore year girlfriend. Maybe he would remember our first date, the one where he texted me at 11 p.m. asking if I wanted to sneak into the dining hall. We had never formally met before, but I saw him at parties, sauntering, smoking. Not to say that I wasn't cool, I just preferred to saunter in lower stakes environments, like the Jewish Student Life Center or my therapist's waiting room. We sat on opposite ends of this grand oak table, observed by oil portraits of long dead headmasters. Unprepared for a booty call that Saturday night, I wore my best acne cream and a novelty pair of panties that read Taco Tuesday. We ended up talking until 5 a.m. That dining hall became sanctified through conversation, through Radiohead albums, midnight panic attacks, and premarital study sessions. These were the quintessential moments of college. The little bits of intimacy you found hidden in between classes, Adderall in your roommate's dirty socks. He and I would later come to be friends, genuinely close, with only a small part of me wondering if amity was just the final symptom of unrequited love. Relegating Tom to the island of misfit exes seemed wasteful. It was, after all, its ending that made this college fling so impactful. Also, thanks to him, I could also now point to Morocco on a map. The tour group outside finally departed, leaving me alone with this new stranger. Trapped inside a life-sized snow globe, I learned my most important lesson of sophomore year. The worst part of a broken heart isn't the loss of love. It's having to suddenly render that love irrelevant. I also realized that, for the first time in my life, I couldn't crack a joke about it. As elegant and profound as these thoughts were, I did not contemplate them in the igloo. In the igloo, I mentally hedged my bets on whether or not I'd ever date another European. In the igloo, I withdrew my hand from his, wiped away snot with my bare arm, and asserted with as much pride as I could muster, "C'est la vie."
Awesome.
You fought for. That's great.
Yeah, that was awesome. So, after Tom, Luna, how do we feel about the French?
I have an unfair bias against the French in after this entire experience. Emily in Paris is me just like plucking leaves off of a daisy, and all of them are saying, "Do you love me?" And then I'm like, "No, you love me not." So,
as a comedian and a very funny one, does Tom's comment about turning problems into material ring true in your life? how and when did you decide to turn something sad into something funny?
So I was like heartbroken. I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to get over this. I can't believe that my cause of death is going to be Frenchman from sophomore year of school. But it was literally like, I think I wrote this 2.5 to 3 weeks after the breakup. So I think that it was a way to kind of work through a lot of the feelings that I had in a useful way, as opposed to doing what I initially did, was like sending the crazy ex-girlfriend email that's like, you never deserve one, I'm an English, where it's just like you screaming it into the void of somebody's inbox. So I think this was a much more productive way to kind of express myself. And he read it and he really enjoyed it. You know, take that as you will.
Oh, Addie, go ahead.
I guess because I feel like people have had this experience of like randos reaching out to them during the pandemic, which is what a friend of mine referred to as groundhogging. And I'm wondering, just because like all this happened before, you know, the world shifted, if he like reached out to you in any way to like rehash what happened. You don't have to reply.
Oh no, I'm an open book to his dismay. I think that we kind of mutually ended up doing that. It was also really weird though. Like, we wrote an article together afterwards and stuff. We have a very kind of untraditional post-relationship. But I think it started off by just sort of the check-in, like, hey, so last time we saw each other, it was a little bit different. What's happening now? And you're like, oh, it's the same, you don't love him. Okay, cool. I think we'll just want to clear that up.
Next up, we have Ronak Gandhi, a Morse junior, talking about procrastination and how he's working to overcome it.
Yeah, so I'm here to talk about why I used to procrastinate, but no longer can procrastinate. I found that in the first 2 years of school, I was a big procrastinator. I can remember like putting off papers till the last minute, like staying up early in the morning to write them, and then going to sleep like as the sun was rising. I remember like doing my math p-sets in Becton Cafe. They were due at 3 p.m. I'd walk into Becton at like 11 in the morning, and I'll just work, and I give myself the 4 hours to do it. And, you know, some days it got done. Some days I walked up to the fourth floor and dropped in an incomplete p-set, but such is the life of a master procrastinator. And, you know, I asked myself, like, why would I procrastinate looking back? And, you know, why would I kind of put myself in that hole? And I really think it was a way of combating my perfectionism, right? Like, it kept my stress to a minimum, because usually if I was trying to be like the early bird student, you know, try to look at the paper way ahead of time, plan it out, outline, draft again, take it to the writing center, take it to a TA, I found that I would just be staring at my computer for hours and hours, like trying to write the perfect sentence, or, you know, like craft the best thesis, or, you know, like sitting there waiting for like the academic Yale muses to like whisper great thoughts into my ear. And I ended up not getting anything done. I also think I just preferred to have my stress be a short burst rather than a slow burn. And it's also not like there were other things on campus to do that were distracting, but also equally important. You know, I found that clubs, extracurriculars, you know, spending 2 hours in the dining hall talking to friends were equally important to getting those papers done, getting those p-sets done, and all the classwork. And, you know, I found that perhaps that wasn't necessarily the best approach later on. You know, there were a few instances early in those first 2 years where red flags were popping up here and there. You know, finals period, spring semester of my first year, you know, I had 24 hours to move out and 24 hours to write a final paper. It was not a great day. But I still procrastinated through my sophomore year. And I found that, you know, it was good for keeping the stress down. But gee, when we reached this fall, like, that did not work. I learned very quickly that those procrastination techniques and strategies were not going to cut it. You know, for whatever reason, like, you would think that like a sane, rational student would look at this semester and say, you know, not having those other distractions like in-person extracurriculars or social life would make someone think that, you know, not have a tendency to procrastinate would be an easy thing to do. But I guess like all those Zoom breaks really added up, and it just meant that I continued putting things off and off and off. And then like I would look back and be like, oh, it's 5 a.m. I still have to write 2 pages on this paper. Why are my procrastination techniques not failing me? You know, I couldn't keep up with the classes. I couldn't keep up with the assignments. And, you know, I'm not exactly sure why this was the case, but I really think it has to do with classes being online on a screen. You know, when you have, you know, your classes behind the computer, and then you also have to do your work behind the computer, do your PSEPs, do your papers behind the computer, I think it just makes it incrementally harder to stay focused after each minute, after each hour on the screen. And eventually, you know, it just piles up and piles up, and, you know, you're left with, you know, Zoom fatigue, you know, as real as it is, although some professors seem not to acknowledge its existence. I found that it was really hard to finish assignments without like large copious amounts of stress piling on. I guess when we already have the kind of slow burn stress that's come with this pandemic, it makes it harder to add those short bursts of stress onto our load. You know, those short bursts of stress that I could usually manage became that much harder. And it became that much harder also because we have that little incremental Zoom fatigue. With each hour you spend behind the computer, you're that much more tired and you're that much more unproductive in that next hour. And it got to a point at which I realized I had to pivot. I had to change. Something had to go. You know how they say the first step is admitting you have a problem? Well, that was kind of the case for me. The first step to fighting procrastination was to frankly admit that I'd stretched myself too thin and admit a sort of academic defeat, you know, raise the white flag. And I mean, it was hard for me to do this, but I ended up dropping a class. It was my first time doing it. But I recognized that I need to focus on my mental health more than ever and not really ignore my worries and anxieties by drowning myself in schoolwork. And surprisingly, drowning myself in my schoolwork was actually counterproductive. Wish I'd realized that sooner. But then I had to pivot, but I had to pivot in a realistic way. I realized that I'm not going to become that kind of early bird student. I'm not going to start papers early or crack down on PSET the day it's assigned. I had to accept that I'm going to be a procrastinator at heart, and that is okay. So I had to play to my procrastination strength. I decided to block off certain time slots only to complete a set task. It's like a self-imposed deadline with an actual punishment or reward. You know, it could be something as simple as no dessert or video games for a day. Or something as, you know, easy as, you know, we get these 5 pages of the paper done, you can take the next day off and things like that. I think just being consistent with it really helped me, and just drilling it into my head that the self-imposed deadline was the actual deadline. And then I think taking an actual project and an overall deadline, for example, a paper, and breaking it down into smaller self-imposed deadlines, right? Like, we're going to have an outline done by this day. This is the deadline. Get it done. We're going to have that first draft done. 2 days after that, get it done. And just following through with all those things really helped. And I know this is weird to say, and because I'm sure a lot of people have like heard this kind of strategy before, but for me, it was like a huge, you know, realization that procrastination isn't great. And, you know, these kind of strategies work. And of course, like, I didn't follow it all the time. I still had a couple of like really late nights, early mornings where I went to bed as the sun was rising. So by no means am I perfect, but I found that pivoting and pivoting smartly was really beneficial. And just being cognizant of my mental health and my state really helped to inform my study strategies and kind of the way I tackle classes. And honestly, tackle these like big life decisions that are really crushing that we talked about at the beginning of the podcast. And at the end, I think learning to be imperfect despite being surrounded by like high pressure or high stakes or other high performing individuals is perfectly all right. I think that accepting imperfection is crucial for being a functioning person. I think that no matter if you look at, like we were talking about earlier, on social media and you see all this perfection, or if you look around you on campus and you feel like you're surrounded by individuals who are like gods, recognizing that perhaps that's not the case for everyone, and recognizing that even if that is the case for everyone, at least for me, I found that there's a lot of solace to be had in the fact that I can do what I can do, and it's all right if I can't do what others can do. I hope that makes sense.
Awesome. Yeah, I totally agree with that. Thank you for sharing. And I have a couple questions for you. So I'm wondering, you sort of talked about Zoom fatigue and you like touched on, you know, the pandemic. And I think like in general, it's been just difficult to do anything during the pandemic just because of the pandemic. I guess in part it's like an interplay of Zoom fatigue and also the pandemic. So I'm wondering for you, how much of it do you think is Zoom fatigue, you know, the worsening of the procrastination, like how much of it do you think is Zoom fatigue versus the pandemic itself? Just, you know, everything that has come with the pandemic.
I honestly can't give you a straight answer for that. I don't know. I think like I have a tendency, as I'm sure, you know, a lot of other people do, to like impose this like academic lens on the problem and be like, what are the causes and the solutions and how can we, you know, delve into researching my personal problems and like how I can feel better. And at the end of the day, like, I can't do that with this. Like, all I know is like the outcome and that, like, you know, something changed in March and now I'm here and I can't do what I used to be able to do. And so we have to pivot and change. And I felt like at the beginning of the semester, I really got bogged down in the point fingers game. And a lot of times I ended up pointing the fingers at myself and blame myself for like, this is why the changes happened. This is why, you know, you're not able to get this paper done. You're not able to like be as social. You're not able to like go outside and go for like a 20-minute jog. And I found that like that was counterproductive. What I really could do instead of figuring out, you know, is this me? Is this Zoom fatigue? Is this COVID? Is this, you know, stuff from home coming back at me? To just put that aside and be like, how can I move forward and just take it day by day? And I know it totally did not answer the question, but I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, I get it. Awesome. Thank you. And I guess like, so you did mention a lot of late nights, especially like early college. So I'm wondering how bad was the procrastination in high school? Did it exist like it does in college or?
I think it was different. I think the procrastination is very different in high school because you have classes every day, you have assignments every day. So it's hard to have a similar sense of procrastinating. Of course, there were like, you know, a few longer essays you turn in high school. It's not to the same length and it's not to the same, what's the word I'm looking for? I'd say like the onus is less on the student almost. You know, you're given so much freedom in college to set your own schedule, to kind of figure things out for you. Whereas, at least in my experience, my teachers would be a little more rigid in deadlining, perhaps because they didn't feel that students were like mature enough or kind of at the academic state to like have these self-imposed deadlines. I think they were right. I mean, you know, I was 21, you know, or 20, and I still could not impose the self-imposed deadline. So they were 100% right on that, at least for me. So I think that's the big difference. So I don't think I noticed the procrastination as much until I got to college and I was more on my own.
That makes sense.
So I found myself relating a lot to the things you were describing when you were talking about how bad your procrastination was, the sort of things that you would do. I was like, wow, that's exactly what I do. And I have been a bad procrastinator for a very long time. And I was just wondering, I guess if somebody is looking to overcome their procrastination, what advice would you give?
Oh gosh, I don't know if I'm perhaps the expert on this, but I'm glad you related to a lot of what I said. I'm glad I'm not the only one out there. I guess my thing is, I found that when I try to like change myself and be like, let's try to become a non-procrastinator, that never really works out well because it's too big of a change, you know, and it's too big of a change for me to cope with or grapple with. So I'm just going to push it aside. We'll change later, you know, classic procrastinator. But I find when I'm like, okay, I'm a procrastinator, I'm going to accept that and I'm going to work to my strengths. Like I'm going to, you know, essentially just say, I'm not going to do any of this assignment until 7 p.m. on, you know, November 29th. And then you procrastinate, you know, don't do any of it, don't think about it. And then I sit down, I'm like, okay, I start at 7 p.m. By 10 p.m., I want to have an outline done. You know, that means, you know, do some research, get some thoughts, get that outline, procrastinate. And I'm not going to lie, the first 2 hours and 30 minutes, pretty unproductive. But that last 30 minutes, spectacular, amazing. Like the hands never leave the keyboard. I guess that's just really what works for me. It's like really being strict about that self-imposed deadline. And like, honestly, it could be as dumb. Like I remember like sitting in this room, you know, during, you know, quarantine in like May, and I would be like, okay, if I don't get this thing done in the next 30 minutes, I'm going to do like 20 burpees and just like punish myself like that. And like, you know, just the thought of like something as mundane as that, like kind of keeps me a little bit more accountable. I don't know. It's like a way of coping with the punishment of like getting the assignment done late to 20 burpees. I don't know if that fully makes sense, but that's my weird way of looking at this.
Next up, we have Addie Kim, a JE senior, and they'll be talking about getting lost in the woods, both spiritually and physically.
Yeah, thanks you guys for your stories so far. I definitely identify with both, and Ronax especially, evidenced by the fact that I did not prepare to tell this story, but here we go. I have one story, but if you guys are lucky, maybe we'll get like two stories that are kind of related in time and space to each other, but we'll see. So this summer, I found myself stuck at the beginning of the pandemic in San Diego, where my dad was raised, and where my grandparents still live. I spent most of my days skateboarding around, smoking a lot of pot, and listening to music, and not much else. But I think I was in a similar place to a lot of people, where at some point I just like needed to get out of a rut and like was seeking like adventure in the most like safe and socially responsible way possible. So my version of that was going to Northern California, where my uncle has a cabin that he built on some like unsanctioned land, and just staying there for about 2 months by myself with like nobody around. So in thinking about this question of like, why did you do that? I really have no answer to that, except for like needing to shake things up. And it was actually a really good experience. I think that at Yale, and like just generally in like liberal kinds of like coastal circles, people like to brag about mindfulness practices, or espouse like the mindfulness practice that they are like aspiring towards. And I am totally guilty of doing that all the time. And I think it was like the first time in my life where like I actually just like had nothing to do. And like it wasn't intentional at all. But I think like having that headspace for a while was like a really good thing. This is so unrelated to my story, but we're going to get there at some point. So that came to a close at a certain point, and I realized, for both like reasons of having a job and like wanting to see my family, I went back down to San Diego. But on the way back, we had a friend who actually graduated from Yale at the end of my first year. They were going on a trip, like a backpacking trip, with some of their friends, mostly, who went to Berkeley in Los Padres, which is like a national forest, or a state forest, I think, 30 minutes north of LA. And I wasn't planning on going, but I was like, pandemic, you know, only live once. Yeah, let's do it. So I had like no gear. Like I only brought like 3 outfits to my uncle's place in Northern California. So that's what I was like prepared with. And we set out on this like 3-day trip in like desert climate. Like it is dry as shit, like 100 degrees. And during the night it gets pretty cold because again it's a desert. But the Los Padres are known for the Sespe hot springs, which are like a hike into the park after you like, you know, go even like I think like 10 miles in. So we had planned for the second day to go on this like day trip. So day trip meaning like if we were backpacking and slept like camping, we just took our stuff for the day to come back to our camp at night. So we were like, let's make it more fun. Let's take some shrooms. Just so you guys know, I'm not like a big, like I don't do psychedelics usually. I think I did them like once before in my life. So I was like trying to be, to answer the question of why'd you do that? To be cool. That's why I did it in that moment. Nothing about it is like that enticing to me. We went out on this day trip, again, 100 degrees, very excited to get to the hot springs. By the way, we have not ingested these shrooms yet because the idea was that we would get there, we would take a dip, it would be like a nice moment, then we would take the shrooms and then have like a nice like trip on our way back. And so the hot springs were 5 miles away from where we were camping. We get there finally. It's like one of those oasis moments where we like kept seeing what looked like a body of water and then we'd like run up to it and it like was not, it was like a ditch. And so that happened 5 times until we found the actual hot springs and they were like scalding hot. Like we could not go in. And so everybody was like really trying to like pretend that like it was all chill though. And like everybody was like really happy and like, I think the maintenance of emotions was like a really big aspect of this trip. And I think really specific to the group of people that I was with that like everybody was the type of person not to like be the Debbie Downer. And I think this contributes a lot to what is going to transpire next, which is that we took these shrooms for the first 30 minutes of walking back, or all and then that, because, you know, it takes a while to hit. For the first hour after, you know, these shrooms started doing their thing, I was like coasting. It was like the best time of my, the landscape was like changing colors. Like we saw a tarantula, but it wasn't scary. It was like magical and it was like speaking to me. At some point it started to get like a little darker and people started like looking weird to me. And like voices sounded very strange. And I think that like that was happening to everybody, but again, nobody was willing to say it. So it felt like a simulation where like nobody was like telling you the truth and shit. And like just everything was took on a new, more imposing kind of like look to it. And at some point, I'm in the front with another, like a friend of mine at this point. I'd met everybody on this trip for the first time. So that's another aspect of it. But I'm at the front, we're leading the two of us, and we are supposed to cross over the river to continue on the main trail. But we see a huge rattlesnake just like go in front of us, and we're like, no. Still tripping again. And so we back up. We're like, we're going to figure this out. If any of you guys have ever been in a canyon, you know that it's like if you follow the ridge line, you like really can't get lost. And so we were like, okay, cool. We're going to follow the ridge line. We're just going to keep going and then we'll find the trail again. So we did that. Big mistake was not telling anybody what we were doing. So at a certain point, everybody was like, we were like hacking through shit and people were like, you're not supposed to do this. Like, are we on the trail or not? And so, we were like, oh yeah, might be like, we did not tell you that we saw a rattlesnake back there. So we just like took it upon ourselves to, you know, go off the path. And they were like, what? So we had to regroup. At this point, tensions were running a little high. You know, people were blaming each other, mostly me. And we were like, it's fine. We'll find the trail again. Could not find the trail. At this point, it's getting really dark. And so everybody is like at each other. At this point, I'm like pretty nervous. And I think like in the past, I've been like someone who under pressure is able to just like block out my emotions and be like, okay, what needs to get done? Like, what are the logical steps we need to take to like figure it out? And I found that like it was the first time, and maybe it's because I was like a little bit under the influence of these shrooms, that like I just couldn't do anything, which was, it was really hard for me as someone who like considered myself to be like a leader and like someone that people can look to for comfort, at least, if not like actual guidance, literally, because I got us lost. But I just couldn't tell everybody that it was going to be okay. And that was like really scary for me. And I was also, yeah, just like so turned around. At some point, G, who is this friend that I knew who like took me on this trip or invited me, was like, wait, that's not the same moon. And I was like, no, we're not going to go there. Like everybody just like not on the same page. And I was like, there's only one moon. And I also think I realized during that, like nobody had like real hiking experience. And so like, it was like a really a performance up until then. And so, yeah, it was just like really wild, all this kind of stuff that came out when, you know, we were all lost. So it was like pitch black at this point, and people were really worried about getting water, and a lot of people didn't want to go on. I was really convinced that me and this other person that I was like leading with were really convinced that if we just kept going like up the ridgeline, we would have found our camp, because we just projected we weren't out for that long and we'd been walking a certain distance, that it could have only been at least like 10 minutes away. And so in that moment, we really had to be like, put that aside, like our, you know, better beliefs for like the comfort of the group, most of which did not trust us. So it wasn't even really a question. And so we were like, okay, let's just go by the river and set up camp without anything. We had, people were being really extra about like rationing food. So it got kind of scary. Like just like the way that people are like, okay, so this is my tuna can. And like, if you want my tuna can, about that. And there was just a lot of like community processing going on about the tuna can. And I was also so cold. Like everybody was like pretty freezing, because as I said, it's a desert, and I only brought a bathing suit for this trip because I was like, that's fun, you know, just to go to the hot springs in bathing suit. And so we ended up making a fire, and sleeping was just like not a thing that we were going to do. It was clear. So my job throughout the entire night was to move this entire tree gradually in front of the flame so that it could continue to burn. And so that was actually good for me because it really preoccupied me and distracted me from really dark thoughts I was having and really self-destructive, kind of like, oh, why did you do that? Going back to the theme of the podcast, you know? And we woke up, or yeah, like I said, we didn't actually sleep, so we didn't wake up. The sun rose eventually, and which is really cool. If you've never had the chance to see a sunrise, I really highly recommend it. Because, I don't know, it's not like everybody thinks to do that. And it's really welcoming. Like, I was really missing the sun that entire night, so I was really happy to see it at some point. But when the sun rose, we finally had the chance to, you know, climb the rocks in a safer way and kind of gauge the situation. And so me and a few other people did exactly that, and we found that the camp was 5 minutes away from us and we could literally see it at the top of the ridgeline. So we weren't wrong, but I didn't feel any need to gloat because it just felt like that wasn't the right thing to do, nor would that provide me with any satisfaction being like vindicated in any way, because I still felt really stupid. But yeah, I eventually made it back home to San Diego to the mundanity of quarantine pandemic life. Did not tell my aging Korean grandparents about what happened, except for that I went on a nice walk with my friends. And yeah, that's it.
Thank you for sharing. That was awesome. That was really funny. So wait, before I ask you some questions, I just have to say, like, I feel like everyone has a friend named G. Is that, like, a universal thing? I feel like I've met so many people who, like, say, oh, like, my friend G. I have a friend named G, too. But anyways, so I am wondering, like, have you talked to the people that you were with about it since that happened? Like, did y'all ever talk about it?
It's kind of like this thing where, it, like, I haven't talked to any of them since except for G. But if I saw any of them on the street, it would be like, we'd be like exuberant and like running into each other's arms. Like, maybe not now, but like, I think we would just like have this unspoken connection of almost having died together. But yeah, no, I don't really talk to them, but it would be good for me like to reach out. So thank you for even suggesting that.
Yeah, no problem. I guess like, since you're talking about meeting these people and not having had talked to them before, what was it like meeting them while on shrooms? Like, just like a new group of people? Cause that's like also part of it, right? Like, you, not only did you get lost, you were like high with them. Like,
yeah. I mean, I think it's like any, I guess drug or like, substance that like alters your perception is that it can also really alter the way that you relate to people. And I think by and large, I'm the kind of person who is like more likely to think that like people and things are more interesting when I'm like high or drunk. And so I think that it did help, but we also like created a moment and like scenarios that I think like were really unique to, I think like outside of having done drugs, that like, I feel like that's like the kind of context in which I understand that I got to know them and not necessarily like having tripped. Because there was like that day before, you know, that we were all together and getting to know each other, which is just like a crazy experience. I think even more than like tripping is like meeting a group of people in like pandemic times, for the first time going on like a crazy backpacking trip together and like having kind of like insane topics to talk about, like how everybody was thinking about their lives now that all this had happened. And like a lot of people were in like really major transition moments, like I know. I was taking time off of school, so I was thinking about that kind of thing. There was someone else who went to Berkeley who was taking like 3 years off already before this and was like, another year. So I think, yeah, that doesn't really answer your question, but I think that's the context in which I feel like I got to know everybody. And then like the shrooms were just like kind of created that moment of like getting lost more than getting to know each other.
Have you seen a rattlesnake since then? Or was that like your first time ever seeing one?
So like, I'm pretty convinced, I'm like 50-50 on whether or not I like actually saw it. So that, I mentioned that in the story as well.
And last but not least, Ingrid Ellis, a Ben Franklin sophomore, calling with a somewhat similar story, but with an elementary school twist.
So the high school that I went to is a private high school in the town that I grew up in Colorado Springs. And it's a boarding school and a day school. So I was a day student there, but a lot of the students there were from other states or other countries from around the world. And one of the big ideas, I guess, of the school, they really want to, I guess, expose the students to Colorado and appreciate the environment that we're in, because it's a relatively, they have a lot of land on the campus. It's on a prairie. It's really beautiful. I was very fortunate to go there. And they have this interim program. And so every March before spring break, the school arranges all these different trips, and you sign up earlier in the year for which trips you want to go on. And then it's a group of students that go on these trips and do all these special things. It's a very cool program. But for the freshmen, they usually do the trips so that they stay in Colorado, again, reinforcing the whole appreciation of Colorado and the environment that we're in. So my freshman year, one of the options was to go on this canoeing trip down the Colorado River, and be camping like on the banks for a week. And I was really excited for it. I had done some canoeing in the past at summer camp, things like that. And I was really excited to, you know, have this bonding experience with some of my classmates. And there were 11 other students, all of them freshmen, because they do the freshman only trips. And then other ones after that, it's usually mixed. But that's besides the point. Anyways, so it was 11 other kids, and we had two teachers, and then there were two guides that were leading us on this canoeing trip. And so the plan, you know, was we would be camping and canoeing and going on hikes when we had time and making all of our own food, all that fun stuff. It being early March, it was pretty cold. Especially at night, we would wake up in the morning and there would be frost on the outside of our tent. One morning, it was so cold that I went to pour myself some hot chocolate, and the water had just come off the stove, so it was really, really hot, and I accidentally poured some on my hands, but all it did was really thaw them. So it didn't hurt at all, having basically boiling water poured on my hands. But so yeah, it was very cold. And on the fourth day, we were planning on going on this hike, kind of, I guess, I'm not even sure where exactly they ended up, because I'll get to that. I had brought along this pair of shoes. I brought along my Keens. If you don't know what Keens are, they're, you know, these, I guess they're, you can call them sandals. They're very outdoorsy type shoes. I guess you could hike in them. They, you know, they say waterproof on them, even though like if you got them wet, they would take a couple hours to dry, which was annoying. But they have like really thick soles, very durable, but you know, they're not completely sealed. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to wear these on the hike. And that was my mistake, because the first maybe 10 minutes or so, we're walking through a field and it's filled with weeds and all these very dry plants, it being, you know, like a canyon, and just the environment, I guess. Very Western, very dry. And so it was a poor decision because all these little spines, pokey things were getting into my shoes. And it was obviously very painful. And it got to the point where I stepped off the trail and like sat down and was picking out all the little spines, prickly things out of my socks and out of my shoes. And at the time, me being a freshman, I had undiagnosed and then it was untreated ADHD. Now I know that I have it. I'm on meds for it, but so it was untreated at the time. And I think what happened is I probably hyper-focused on getting all the little spine things out. And so it took a whole lot longer than it should have, maybe 5-6 minutes. I don't know, maybe it should take 2 minutes. And when I looked up, I couldn't see the rest of my group. And I knew that we were kind of close to the campsite because obviously we had only been walking for maybe 10 minutes. And despite there being like no trees, since it was just a canyon, lots of very short weeds and shrubs, and there was a trail, but I couldn't see anyone. So I was following the trail, you know, in the direction that we were going, but then it eventually forked. And so I stopped and thought to myself, huh, okay, there are two options here. I can pick one of the trails and hopefully run into the group of students and then the teachers that were with us, or I can sit here and wait for them to come back for me. And it being a fork in the trail, I thought, you know, there's a 50% chance that I choose the wrong one here. I think I'm just going to sit here and wait. And I knew that the teachers would obviously be very mad because it was my own fault. I wasn't paying attention where everybody was going. I had chosen the wrong shoes. And I thought about that a lot while I was sitting there and waiting. I was pacing around sometimes, just trying to pass the time. There wasn't a whole lot to do, just me in a field next to the river in this canyon. And so I sat there and I waited a while, and eventually the sun was starting to set a little. It was still very bright out, obviously, but because of the canyon, the shadow was moving closer and closer to me next to the river. And then eventually it was covering up the area that I was standing in, and I would be moving into the sun to try and stay warmer. But it got to the point where I was like, okay, waiting here is not productive. And I think I had to go to the bathroom or something. Eventually I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to go back to the campsite, because it was just, I just had to walk the direction that we came from. And then the two river guides were there, and I think they might have said something to me. It wasn't anything, I don't know, they weren't like, why aren't you with the group or anything. They were just, I think they just asked me like, oh, is it just you? And I was like, yep. I stopped to fix my shoes and the group continued on without me. And so now I'm back here. And then maybe 45 minutes later, everybody else got back. And surprisingly, the teachers, they didn't say anything to me at first. I was scared shitless, basically, that they were going to yell at me and that I was like going to get in huge trouble, because I was a huge goody two shoes and I had never done anything that would get me in trouble before. And this was like the first time that anything, I guess, with potentially major consequences, it was the first time that something like that had happened to me. And the one teacher that I was most worried about, his name was Mr. Haupt. We had been calling him Hopter, because he just kind of covered everywhere and was making sure that everything was running smoothly, that everybody was sticking to the schedule, that food was getting made, that we weren't goofing off or anything. I was really worried about him, because he was, I guess, the stricter of the two. But nothing happened. nobody addressed it. I was terrified that they were going to berate me about it, but it didn't even mention it. I think some other people had asked me, you know, like, hey, what happened to you? And I explained what had happened. And I don't know, it was definitely a unique experience. And so I don't recommend hiking in Keens anymore. And I haven't done it since. I don't think I've worn them since. But yeah, so that's what happened.
Awesome. Thank you. I do have a question. Did you buy like new hiking shoes? Have you been hiking since? Have you been on like a big hiking
trip? Oh yeah. Yeah, sure. For sure. I have hiking boots. I go on hikes regularly, or sometimes, you know, it's just whenever the opportunity presents itself. It's not like that's the last hike I've ever been on, and I don't plan to ever hike ever again. But it's because I enjoy hiking, and it's a good time. But I haven't worn the Keens, mostly because I grew out of them. But
were you, while you were waiting at the fork, like you described your fear of your like teachers and stuff a lot, but like, did you have other fears, like that you just be stuck there? I don't know. How'd you feel otherwise? Like other fears that you had, maybe?
I don't know how scared I actually was. I was more concerned like, oh no, what are the teachers gonna say? But me being by myself on a trail when I'm supposed to be like with the school group, I probably wasn't as freaked out as maybe I should have been. But it was a long time ago, so I don't remember everything that I was thinking about. I do remember I was pacing around for a while because I had to pee, but because of the river being right there, I knew that I couldn't just pee in the bushes. So, but I was trying to stay in the sun, keep warm. Thinking about like, how long are they going to be gone? Are they still walking? What are they doing now? And I have pictures from the rest of their hike, so I can see where they went. And it's funny because, you know, I'm not in the pictures and I know exactly where I was when they were taken. So.
And that is all for this episode of 1C Over. Thank you to our storytellers for taking a chance on the Scrappy podcast and sharing parts of who you are with us. We hope you learned, you laughed, and now we want to hear from you. Our next episode's theme will be, who's your daddy or anyone else? Stories about family, whatever shape they may take. If you have a story or know someone with a story, please email us at 1COver@gmail.com. Every idea is a good idea, and we have a team of editors ready to help make your work the best it can be. It's low stress, lots of fun, and we want everyone's stories to be heard. If we want to make Yale a more welcoming space, it starts with you. Thank you for tuning in. Thanks again to our wonderful storytellers. We hope to hear your stories soon. Catch you in the next one.